Welcome to Scotch Friday Podcast. My name is Carmel Sacrin, and I'm your host. This podcast is part of our social justice series following the tragic death of George Floyd. Tonight, our long-awaited youth panel have their say. Let's listen to their views and insights on the obstacles and solutions to achieving social justice. We join our moderator, Martin Downey, in conversation with our youth panel.
Okay, good evening, everybody. This is the Scotch Fridays podcast, and this is a conversation regarding youth and social justice, and one in which we are now this evening speaking directly to a youth panel that we've convened for the purposes of getting their impressions and their understanding of what it is that is changing the world right now in terms of social justice. And we'd like to hear their thoughts and their comments on just exactly how that influences their lives. And so tonight we have gathered a group of youth, as the term denotes, and for which I'm going to run through a fairly quick introduction here of the youth members of this panel this evening. We'll start with Sahar El Khatoub. Sahar, perhaps you can wave. Sahar is a Canadian-Lebanese immigrant and a first-generation law student who has recently graduated from the University of Windsor. Congratulations, Sahar. Gabrielle Fayant is co-founder of Assembly of Seven Generations. She originates from Fishing Lake Métis Settlement in Alberta and identifies as a proud Michif woman. Wave, Gabrielle. Give us a wave. Nadia Figuera is the Employment Placement Counselor for the YMCA Hamilton Brantford Burlington region, and she's responsible for employment and training services. Hello, Nadia.
Hi.
Mark Swan. Mark is a product design lead at Senso Minds, a company dedicated to designing toys and kits to support the special needs community. Good evening, Mark.
Hey, good evening.
And Kiera Silverglen. Kiera is an African-American actor, writer, and intersectional activist who currently attends York University. Kiera, welcome to you too.
Hi.
Additionally, on our panel, of course, is Rita Scott, Rajiv Wijesingha, and, of course, Renee Pepin. Thank you all for being here this evening, and hopefully we'll have an engaging conversation that will perhaps lead us to some further conclusions and thoughts and suggestions as to where life should go from here, maybe, if that's not too tall an order for all of us. One of the things we've done, of course, in the past to prepare for this conversation was to put together a series of questions for this panel, for which we hope to generate that conversation from. So we're going to start by putting out the first question, which is very simply this. And the question, again, directed to youth, as we've mentioned earlier, is this. As youth, what does social justice mean to you? Now, Sahar, I know you and I, we have spoken briefly in the past, so perhaps you might want to start off because I know you have some thoughts on this.
So I think social justice starts from listening to racialized minorities and women. So I think a big part of social justice at the moment to us is defunding the police. I see that as a form of social, this is one of the biggest ones at the moment. And I think of the 94 calls to action for TRC, which are the, it's something that was released, I believe, in 2014. That could be really off. 2015, actually. Released in 2015, and there are 94 calls to address the issues that have happened historically and still happen now, with especially the missing and murdered Indigenous women in Canadian society. And there's 94 of them, and they're all listed, and people should look at them and start taking them more seriously, and they should be part of our social justice movement. Those are my two things right now: defunding the police and the 94 calls is priority in Canada.
Sorry, Sahar, the 94 calls are listed where exactly? What was the title of that?
It's called the Truth and Reconciliation
Conference. Oh, the Truth and Reconciliation Conference. Yes, of course. Yes, right. Tell me, Kiera, any thoughts on that, particularly in terms of the defunding of the police movement? I know that you're involved with Black Lives Movement. Tell me, how strongly do you feel about the concept of defunding police in this respect, whether that's here in Canada or the U.S. for that matter?
I am pro defunding the police
in Canada and the U.S. I have family in the U.S., but I have Black family in Canada. And after George Floyd's death, we kind of sat together and we talked about what exactly defunding the police means. And I'm really proud of Hamilton. A whole bunch of youth got together in the past weeks and said, we don't want police in our school system. We're done with that. And they actually achieved that. So there's no more police going to be in the coming school year
in Hamilton.
Yeah. In Hamilton. So I'm really proud of what the youth did here. I'm hoping that we can work together to defund the police, because that doesn't mean we don't. Is it not anti-police? Right. I think that message can be confusing for some people, but I'm definitely
right. That's clearly something that I've seen in the press as well, is that there's a great misconception of what defunding the police really means. But the reality is that it seems that the amount of funding that goes towards police work and police efforts these days doesn't seem to be directed at some of the causes that we're talking about here.
Yeah.
And that's where it may be a bit of a failure. So so is that a common theme throughout, for instance, with yourself, Gabrielle? What do you think in terms of defunding police? Is that a priority for what you see in terms of social change?
Yeah, 100%. You know, Indigenous communities have been underfunded and underserved in so many capacities and over-surveillanced for the last 150 years. Mm-hmm. You know, so for us, like, defunding the police means more money into grassroots Indigenous youth community building. You know, and so I'm the co-founder and co-CEO of a grassroots youth organization. And we work off of like $5,000 a year.
Wow, really?
Yet we're serving like all the youth in Ottawa. So it's really about equity and justice and fairness and putting resources back into the hands of community builders and people that are really creating as safe place as possible. And it's about, you know, making sure we cause as little harm on this generation and the next generations. So that's what I believe all these movements are all about, is just reducing the harm we perpetuate onto each other.
Gabrielle, tell me, I want to come back to you again on the point that Sahar made regarding the 94 calls to action, but I think I'm going to just move on for a moment and just come back again. As I said, Nadia, where do you see this happening in terms of defunding the police, among other things, or among other issues? Is that, again, something that would make a difference in your day-to-day life as far as the function that you perform with the YMCA group as such? Is that something you would interact with in any way?
For myself personally, I feel like I've had the privilege where I haven't had difficulties with the police. However, yes, at work, definitely with people that I deal with, or even issues related to, like, I work in downtown Hamilton, so a lot of mental health crises come up, many things towards that, and I feel like that there's not enough funding to call on a mental health worker rather than calling a police officer to handle, you know, a homeless person who may be doing drugs in the washroom. And I think it's very important, because at the same time, I do want to handle the situation safely as well as the rest of my staff. But at the same time, calling the police may put this person's life at risk. Mm-hmm. And, so I'm all for defunding the police. I also wanted to mention of the WSB Kids Need Help, that because of their efforts and their protesting, that the police are no longer going to be in the Hamilton public schools, which is a huge win for them. Hmm. And yeah, so I'm definitely all for that.
Sorry, WSB, Nadia, can you explain?
So the Hamilton Wentworth District School Board.
Oh, I see. Okay.
It was a youth led program that led to having police taken out of schools. So,
okay, very good indeed. And I think that's vital in that sense, because obviously if we're heading in the direction of defunding the police in that sense, then obviously school systems would be a primary place where that should occur first, I would think. Mark, it seems to me that you must have some thoughts on this as well in terms of defunding police or various other thoughts on just where we are today in terms of social justice in general.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I think everybody else pretty much covered all the bases I want to really speak on or was going to speak on. You know, you look at the numbers and it's just staggering to see how much money is being devoted towards the police corps and how little is being devoted to actual services which are going to the community. So to kind of answer the question about like what does social justice mean to me, it's just about listening. You know, as I forgot who was speaking in the beginning, but just listening to the minority communities, because they're the ones of whom are going through it. They're the individuals of whom are truly suffering through the injustices and the, you know, the inequalities of which they experience every single day. So if you simply just listen to them and ask, like, what the hell do they need, as opposed to just policing everything, you know, it just makes sense to me. It just makes common sense to really devote, you know, time, resources, and money into the, I guess, the services of which, you know, are dedicated and are suited towards solving very niche problems, as opposed to just blanketing everything with the police state. I don't know. That's just me.
Well, let's expand on that a little bit. And this goes out to all of you and any of you, including Rajiv and Rita and Renee as well, if you don't mind. Where should that money go? If we defund the police and all that budgetary money is now redirected somewhere, any thoughts as to where, what kind of areas we should be focusing on specifically, or should it be spread around in many ways? Sahar, I see you nodding your head there very, very adamantly. I've got a thought as to where that should go.
I think it has been addressed by some of my colleagues on here. It needs to go to Black communities. It needs to go to Indigenous communities. It has to go to racialized communities in the proper NGOs, the proper people who are actually servicing racialized minorities, rather than just over policing them. And I don't want to make this a law thing. Like, I don't want to bring my law school class in, but we live in a society where 9/10 of the law comes from property. And at one point, racialized minorities and women were considered property.
Right.
So, and that's a big part of how police has been used. It's been historically used to help people like keep their property to themselves, and ensuring that everyone's property rights are dealt with. And if you were at one point property, how is something like the police built for you? It was never built for you. It was built for someone else to control you.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's quite something. That's a bit of a revelation for me. I had not thought of that way before. Let's hear from the experienced individuals in the panel here this evening. Rita, your thoughts on this as well at this point?
I think that defunding the police is a really significant step, very badly needed. And I agree absolutely with those who have said, let's direct attention to the places where it's needed instead of just policing everything. And what we know from past experience is that the grassroots groups, community-based groups, typically very poorly funded, but have been the most effective in dealing with issues of poverty and marginalized people, things like street workers for Aboriginal youth in the downtown core of big cities, sex trade workers having outreach workers that meet with them and give them information, keep them safe, give them options, those kinds of things, and other kinds of grassroots community groups that have dealt with youth at risk, getting them into things like wilderness activities and things that help them to develop their own sense of self-confidence and self-esteem. All of those kinds of things have been way more effective than any kind of money going into policing services. And I think if we could focus ourselves on thinking about what is it that needs attention? Is it the mental health issues that the police have the most trouble with? Addictions, poverty, people with serious problems of being dislocated and having nowhere to be, all of those kinds of things can best be worked with by community-based groups that have a vested interest and a unique experience of working with those kinds of folks. And that's where the money should go, because that's what works.
Well, tell me though, and this is open to everybody involved here now, do we think there's enough of an impetus right now, given the certain things that have gone on recently, given George Floyd's murder, given some of the Black Lives Movement protests, given the situation in Portland, Oregon, that is pretty abhorrent in some ways, do we have enough of an impetus to see any significant change occurring, particularly here in Canada? Do we see this being enough to change things?
Can I jump in?
Sure. It's your show.
I think there's a much broader awareness of the issues, and I think we're now having a broader discussion. I'm seeing now quite regularly on the news since the George Floyd video and the protests that we're seeing almost a daily protests. We're seeing daily confrontation, and we're seeing more of a questionable police conduct. But I also think that we've empowered the police too much. I think our laws empower them too much. I think we've over-criminalized a lot of things in our society. And I think we need to start to re-examine exactly what should be criminal and what should not be criminal. And I think we need to continue the conversation and ensure that awareness spreads and it leads to some positive changes. I think defunding the police is really the start. It's the tip. It's not the be all or end all. I think we're just saying demilitarize them. They don't need that much military or heavy equipment. I heard in Montreal, for example, they funded the purchase of 150 body cameras, and the police are refusing to wear them. And the issue is that the union is blaming management for not providing a pilot test, and that's why they're resisting it. I think that's an issue there. I mean, how is it that an easy solution to look at and really kind of put the police on notice that your actions are being monitored? A body camera sounds like an immediate, straightforward way of reining in aggression, and it's not being done by the police. I don't see the issue there. So those are my simple comments.
Yeah, the point there would of course be that there's some underlying motivations beyond, I think, just the notion that a union has the right to overturn something like that. I think we're dealing with some significantly greater, in fact, belief systems within the police forces that says, here's who we are, this is what we do, and you better just like it or leave it. I don't think we're seeing the police force as a social justice committee of any kind, typically. And I hate to say that that's true for everybody involved in policing, and I'm sure it's not, perhaps, but at the same time, the impression and the image we're getting in public display time and time again every day lately seems to be just that. But I'm going to come back to a point that Sahar made regarding the 94 calls to action in that report that took place here a few years back. And I know, Rita, you were involved in parts of that, I believe. But I'm curious to know, if I could, what Gabrielle's thoughts might be on those calls to action. Do we see any activity happening actually at all in the Indigenous communities that you're working with and that you're familiar with at this point regarding those?
Yeah, so just to like touch base on kind of like that idea that not all cops are bad, you know, the reality is that this comes down to systemic racism. Mm. And so systemic racism, it doesn't matter who is there. It doesn't matter if you're white or black or a person of color or Indigenous. If systemic racism is alive and thriving, it's still there. It's still hurting people. And so that's what we really need to address. It's not really the individuals that are working there, but it's the systemic racism. Right. And so this goes back to how residential schools were even created. You know, residential schools was a Canadian policy. Imagine that, a Canadian policy 100 years ago to remove the Indian in the child. Right. And it was a violent and horrific, they were horrific places. And I'm an intergenerational survivor of many of those places. And so for me, it was really powerful when we heard about the TRC calls to action. It was like, wow, we're gonna get somewhere. You know, we're gonna see some change. And then here we are, you know, like more than 5 years later. And it's just like little small symbolic steps, you know. And then there was also the calls to justice on behalf of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls and Two-Spirit people. And we haven't seen any calls to justice being honored, you know. And before that, there was the RCAP report. And so that's what people are forgetting, is that these calls to action and calls to justice actually come from recommendations from the RCAP report that's over 20 years old, and those recommendations weren't listened to. So Canada has access to, I would say, over 600, you know, guidelines and recommendations on how they can remove systemic racism, but yet Canada still hasn't listened to our voices.
Are there specific things, Gabrielle, that you would like to see changed? Are there any one or two things that pop to mind immediately in that respect?
Yeah, like for me, a huge one is TRC Call to Action 66. So okay. TRC Call to Action 66, I worked on myself. I wrote a roadmap on how Canada can reach TRC 66. It was shelved, it was ignored. But for me, as a grassroots youth worker, it's really important because it asks for multi-year funding for grassroots youth organizations and programs on reconciliation. And, you know, that's where I think that money we talk about from defunding the police, that's where it could go. And we're not even asking for a whole bunch of money. You know, we just need the bare minimum to work on restorative justice programs, cultural resurgence, language programs. We just want to be on the land.
Right. I think that takes us kind of into the next question here, which is kind of been what's been leading up to some of these points being made just in the last few minutes here about how we consider as youth whether or not you have the influence over the adults who make these decisions, if you will, on this social justice agenda, particularly when you say some of these things were shelved, you weren't heard. How, as youth, as a whole, for instance, would you think that you may be able to influence those changes in some way? If there is a roadmap for that, do any of you have any thoughts in terms of how that can happen? And the reason we bring that point up, of course, is because historically speaking, we've seen the youth of society make those changes successfully. And points of reference have been made here in the past in previous discussions about the Vietnam War and other such examples. So, you know, do you see, you know, where does your influence lie in that respect? And do you see anything coming because of it? Kiera or Nadia, any thoughts on that?
I think social media is a really powerful tool that youth can use if you have access to it. However, maybe I'm a little bit of a pessimist, I don't know, but a lot of people have come to me and said, oh my goodness, look at the Black Lives Matter movement, isn't this great? You know, look what youth are doing, we're out in the streets protesting and all of that. But people forget, we were out in the streets protesting when Trayvon Martin was killed, when Philando Castile was killed, when Sandra Bland was killed, when Mike Brown put his hands in the air and said, hands up, don't shoot. It's exhausting, you know? And in my opinion, I haven't seen a lot change. So, but as social media grows and more kids are using their voices and feeling empowered to use their voices, I am seeing little bits of hope. Even just, my sister was informing me, I didn't even know this, but on TikTok, somehow they sold out Trump's rally. Yes. I'm not really even sure how that happened. Oh,
yes, but that would be interesting.
But so I think youth are using their voices the best they can on media platforms like that.
So when it comes to you know, taking initiatives such as defunding the police, taking initiative of encouraging these specific calls to action, getting some kind of response to those, beyond social media, is there anything else that can be done?
I mean, I think even just organizing in your local communities is powerful. I mean, in Hamilton, we had a whole bunch of protests, and in Chicago, there's a whole bunch of protests that were organized by youth who went out to the communities and say, I feel powerless. Can we organize something? And so any type of community building, I think, is important, and getting out in the community and stuff like that.
Mark, some thoughts on that?
I think on a smaller scale, at least within families too, you know, speaking as an immigrant, you know, there's a lot of prejudice and biases which the new generation has to come to terms with and has to face with respect to their parents. And being able to have those hard conversations is a start as well. Mm. And I think that's something which immigrant children, especially, you know, being Asian, you know, I fall within that token immigrant little group where, you know, we're oftentimes utilized in arguments to, I guess, devalue or demean certain stances, such as the Black Lives Matter movement, which is, you know, it's not right. So I think the biggest thing, not biggest thing, but one of the things we can do, like as of now, and what I mean by we, I mean individuals of whom are, you know, white or, you know, heck, even BIPOC, like people of color, like we're the biggest proponents of this, where there is a lot of internalized racism within our own communities and within our own family. So being able to confront that and being able to have those hard conversations is a start. And hopefully that can hopefully snowball into more meaningful actions, not meaningful, but more impactful actions, which stem out into the community. But being able to start where you live, where you sleep, and the people you talk to the most is really important.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And I guess that's been true of a few various generations as well in terms of changes such as that. And a very key point. And I'm glad you brought that up. I want to go to Sahar for a moment here about social justice among her law graduates, for instance. Do you think they carry the same interest and awareness in bringing about changes, positive changes, as you do?
So I really struggle with this question. I struggle with it twofold. I think the first thing I struggle with is the fact that there's a really heavy expectation on racialized people to educate. Like, it's kind of become this kind of burden taken on to tell people that what you, to show people that to care, or tell people to care, or influence people to care. I think it's also usually, unfortunately, put on a lot of racialized women more than men, where they're just expected to carry this free labor of educating and being understanding of the racism brought into their communities, and that's impacting their youth, their partners, their families. So I really struggle with this question because it's putting a lot of pressure on the youth to educate the adults, but it's honestly, you can go online and you can Google so much stuff, and you can learn about any topic you want. It's that you have to be okay and open to learn. So to relate it back to my law school classes, I went to Angelo, and I'm very grateful I went there. I love law school. And I loved the Winslow specifically because it was so focused on access justice issues. So we had indigenous legal traditions of the class, we had access justice classrooms. I sat in classrooms with people, and there's some mandatory classes. I sat in these classes with people who would talk about different social justice stuff. And then I'd be in the hallways with them, and usually they are privileged white males, and they're making fun and belittling the class that they just went to, and they're talking about how ridiculous it is that they're using one of their mandatory classes for this kind of law. So it didn't matter. It didn't matter how much information you had. It didn't matter how much information was like, they had lawyers and professors who were so educated in these topics. Amazing. They've written books about this. They've written scholarly works about this, but they didn't care. The issue wasn't the knowledge. The issue was the fact that they don't see this as a personal issue for them. So as we've talked before, systemic racism impacts racialized minorities, and the only way you can change systemic racism is when the non-racialized minorities and the people with power actually move forward and allow us and create like systemic change. We can't sit around, we can turn black and blue here, and all of us could just keep agreeing about how this needs to change, but none of us have the political power nor the systemic power to change it from a large level. Of course, from a personal level, talking to your family is important, talking to your community is important. And I think I've mentioned this to you before, Martin. I told you last time, but I'm really sick and tired of talking to white people about race. So now I've just focused all of my energy talking to the Arab community about race, because I belong in the Arab community and I want to help my community become a welcoming community to all types of racialized minorities and women, therefore creating safe spaces within Canada that I know are usually excluded from the conversation. So I think that's why I really struggle with this question. It's putting a lot of pressure on one group of people when it's not the role of the youth to teach the adults. It's our role to maybe guide you, but it's not our role to sit here and make sure that you understand and you care.
Fair enough, Sahar. I concur that yes, we should know better. There's no question. And fortunately, I think some of us do know better, but the systemic element to that is the real issue and the real problem, because it is so ingrained in some of our mindsets that it's hard to imagine anything else until you're made aware of it by either scenarios like the George Floyd killing or other events that are going on. And even then, that doesn't necessarily win over the individuals that you're referring to. As a group, a question for all of you in this case is, how do we go, though, from talk, something Sahar has just kind of touched on, being tired of talking in a way, but how do we go from that talk to actually, you know, some real real positive action? Any kind of thoughts on what that might look like? What sort of action beyond perhaps what we're doing or seeing at least already? What else can be done, if anything? Nadia, let's hear from you. Nadia, go ahead.
I was going to say, by putting youth or Black people, Indigenous people, other minority groups into positions of power or higher positions, or giving opportunities to youth for higher positions so that they can add to the changes that are happening and they can have some say and some power in what's going on. I think the biggest thing is to just listen to youth, listen to Black people's voices and to Indigenous people's voices and hear what they want to say and what changes, and actually listen to them and make these changes. I definitely agree that there's a lot of symbolic movement, maybe doing something as a gesture to show that, yeah, there is some change, or yeah, we apologize for this, or we're doing this, but it's not any concrete changes that are being done.
Well, on that note, in your role as in involved in employment as such, do you see any of those changes occurring where you're getting opportunities to place people in positions such as you just described, or are you still running up against brick walls?
Well, it's difficult to say. A lot of the people that I do work with, they come in, a lot of them are actually newcomers. So they face their own barriers. And I do notice the types of barriers that newcomers face when they are also not only a newcomer, but a racialized minority. And so in that context, yes, it does can create some more barriers towards that person. It's hard for me to say if I see any change, because I do help them with general job search, so it's kind of hard to...
Yeah. Mark, you had something to add there earlier. I kind of cut you off, but if you had some thoughts on how do we make this talk turn into action. Any thoughts on that?
I guess to be quite honest with you, it's tough because as Sahar was saying, you know, that large sweeping change can only come from individuals within power or people of whom benefit from the privilege which has already been set in place. Like, it's a very big, like, it's just a huge feedback loop where it's hard for minorities and Black and Indigenous communities to truly make a change. And while we can, you know, keep up the activism and keep up the pressure on social media, it's very tough. But I hope that, you know, like to build off the last point with respect to employment, you know, being able to increase representation within organizations, that one does kind of stem from the individuals themselves, from hiring managers and preventing them from being able to profile individuals just on the basis of a name. Like, that's a very like small instance. But, you know, by keeping up that pressure on social media and hitting people where they're most present, hopefully that representation won't come from a place of guilt, but it comes from a place of understanding. And I think that's one of the biggest things which I truly hope we can do in the short term or medium term. It's being able to enact change within people's minds, not because it's performative, not because it's coming from a place of, oh, like, if I don't do this, people will judge me, but because they inherently see that there's an issue here. There's a glaring disparity in equity and equality within our society, and that they actually do have a role and they can contribute to being able to, you know, uplift those communities, whether it is through just an individual or community. As for large sweeping change, that's something which I'm still trying to look into, and I'm wondering how exactly I can fit into that. And I'm here to learn just as much as everybody else. So if anybody else on the panel has anything to share on that topic, I'm all ears, because I really do want to be able to join you guys in that as well.
Well, I think it does touch back to something Sahar said in terms of, you know, your role isn't necessarily to teach adults as how to do this. But on the other hand, your role, no matter how it displays itself, has a strong influence on that. As I mentioned earlier, in terms of some of the historic things that have happened in the past that have done just that.
I could jump into that actually, because I worked in trying to create systemic changes for so long, and what I found is that sometimes we have to just do it ourselves. Mm-hmm. We can't wait for those more privileged to catch up to our understanding of things or expect them to do better. Because there is a real struggle for power. Like when it really comes down to it, it's about power and those with privilege holding on to power. So what we're working on right now is actually an Indigenous youth services evaluation. So there's tons of like youth services out there that say that they work with Indigenous youth, and they actually make money saying that they work with Indigenous youth. So we're going to evaluate how well they actually work with Indigenous youth and give them a rating. And this will be Indigenous youth led. Indigenous youth will be going in and being the evaluators. And I hope that creates a bit of like a breakthrough. And I think that other communities could do similar things like that. You know, like all of you are saying, there's been so many generations of education. You know, there's no excuse right now in 2020 for someone to be racist. There's no excuse. All the information they need exists. But right now, we're moving into an era of accountability. And so those that continue to perpetuate racism or harm or sexism, they're going to be held accountable. And so that's what we're moving into.
Right. And that's a really cool idea you've got going there. And I think that's something that might just plant the seed for others. And I would like to follow up with you on that at some point as well, because that, if nothing else, might be the momentum to start that snowball effect that gathers in other areas of the country and gets something going. So let's talk about education in regards to racialized minorities. Are there distinct barriers to all forms of education at all levels at this point in time, or is it readily available for anybody in the country? I know certainly in remote parts of the country it's probably difficult no matter what, but is that a real issue that's leading to some of these issues, that's causing some of these problems? Jump in, anyone. I see nodding heads. Oh, Nadia, you're on mute.
Yeah. I definitely feel like there is a lack of education in our school systems, in elementary school and high school, for Black history and also Indigenous history, because to be honest, I didn't like I was given the history of what happened in Canada towards Indigenous people in high school, but it was a very sugar-coated and whitewashed version of it. And then when I went to college, I was like, oh my God, like it definitely is a problem with education, of course, especially because you're forming young minds. And also I feel like anti-racism should be taught in school. And so as of right now, yeah, you do have the option to do your own research and to educate yourself, but I think it definitely should start in the education system.
Indeed. Sahar, I see you nodding in on that as well. I'm sure you have some thoughts.
I remember when because I migrated to Canada when I was about 12. And when I got to geography class, I was actually struck by how limited geography is in Canada with regard to, or just in the educational system itself, where I think we only learned about rocks and we learned about the five Great Lakes. That is the extent of geography to grade 9 in Canada, in Ontario, the TVDFC school board that I went to. And I was shocked because when I lived in the Middle East, that wasn't how geography went. And people can talk down so much about the Middle East, but geography in the Middle East was actually geography. You learn about different cultures. You learn about different people's perspectives about life. That was so limited. And it was almost disheartening because I was just watching. I was watching myself just completely diminish my racialized side. Like the fact that I'm Lebanese was never talked about in class. It's geography class. You think they talk about the rest of the world? And there's an atlas involved somewhere. So that was a very big shocker for me. And before going to law school, that's something that I was really considering doing, an educational psychology perspective about minorities going into classrooms where the history is just completely whitewashed. Like, I didn't learn about Indigenous issues until I was in grade 10. That's terrible. Like, I can't even find the proper words for that. It's awful that in grade 10 is when I learned about the people of Canada, like the people that we have completely systemically ruined, basically. And it was also sugar-coated and whitewashed, as Nadia mentioned. It's unfortunate that now at the age of 26, I'm learning more about things that I should have learned in a high school setting or in a public school setting, and that should have been normalized or talked about. I don't want to say normalized because they're not normalized, but like just talked about in those classroom settings and how we can move forward. I think a lot of people put white fragility first above safety for everyone in that room. And it's unfortunate that our education system is so limited at the moment.
That speaks volumes really about where we're at today, how that has been, a problem for many, many years. Case in point, my Canadian history and geography lessons from way back when, I was shocked to hear as an adult that there were actually Black Canadians living in the Maritimes. That was a complete and utter shock to me. I had no idea. And even some of them with my last name, which was also stunning. So I agree. That's been a huge blanket of opportunity for, administrators and educators to say, let's just keep this under wraps because, gee, it's too much of a controversial issue perhaps or whatever. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, it's time. It's well past time to get these points out and get them made and get some action taken. And I like what Gabrielle has said about the movement that is generated from within. It's kind of an organic thought that perhaps that will hopefully get a bit of a toehold in some of this. Let's talk a little bit about corporations and governments and other private companies and so forth. Should it be mandatory, for instance, to have to implement sensitivity training in the commercial world, in the commercial employment world? Does that make sense, Kira? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think whether you're talking about the education system or any other organization, I think it's almost imperative that all staff go through anti-racist and anti-oppression and sensitivity training. I mean, you're dealing with people from all cultures and backgrounds. I think that a lot of people aren't equipped to deal with some of the issues that might arise appropriately. In my experience in the education system, almost no one was trained in anti-racist practices, and it soured my entire experience of school. So I think it's really important that, yeah, everyone goes through those kind of things.
Indeed. Kira, if you don't mind, a little side note here, you've kind of gotten sort of lost in the light here. We've hardly, since it's got a little darker outside, you're blending into the background.
Yeah, I can see that. I do apologize. My house is really loud. There's a lot of little people running around, so I'm in my sun porch. Okay. So I do apologize about that.
Okay, no problem. We hear your voice loud and clear. Okay, so any thoughts in terms of what youth might be able to do for coming back a little bit to the question about education and the lack of a real clear, true education in terms of some of these things. What can youth do to push for better curriculums in schools, if anything, at this point? I know you're perhaps all well past the point of being in school, but at the same time, is there some thoughts on what changes need to be made there in terms of those of us who are parents of children in school, for instance? Any thoughts at all from anyone on that point? Well, let's maybe move on then to the role that governments and education systems and so on have on social justice matters. We've mentioned this in previous conversations and have treated it as a separate question here, as you know. What role really should governments be doing in that sense, particularly in regards to education, as we talked about, but also just in general policy? We know that some of them are perhaps fairly obvious, but how do we get them to move in that sense beyond the social media campaigns, the protests and whatnot? Question of is it just a matter of voting for the right person at the right time, or is there something else? Anybody's thoughts on that one at this point? No. Okay.
If I can jump in, Martin.
Please.
I mean, there's a lot of great ideas floating around from all the panelists. They've come up with some great ideas. And the question is, how do you take those ideas and make them into laws? I mean, when I started out as a young lawyer, I worked in government. And in that particular government office, lawyers wrote statutes. They wrote laws. And basically, the attorney general would send a memo to one of the lawyers in the Crown Law Office, and they would say, we need a piece of legislation on accessibility or something that happens to be relevant for that time. I would just share with the youth the idea that you can actually write letters to the Attorney General of Ontario and to the federal Attorney General. They do make laws. They do listen. And I want to just, you can walk the streets with a placard, with a message, and you can also educate the lawmakers. So if I could ask a question to all the panelists, all the youth panelists, what would you do to educate the people that make the laws? Do you see them as individuals, or do you see them as abstract entities?
Honestly, I see them as abstract entities, because there's a lot of, like, it's not just one person reading my laws and like reading whatever I brought before them and then saying, okay. It's not as pretty as that. Like, anti-racism isn't a cute bow at the top of something. It's messy, it's dirty, and that's not how laws will pass through. There's a lot of layers within the government that I think will stop things, or will lead to delays, or will lead to change or amendments that actually don't impact society as a whole from what the law was intended to do. So I think handing in information about some sort of legislation that you want to pass through is great, but there's so much steps within that lead to either minimizing or diminishing what you're actually trying to get to.
I would also add that I'm not really interested in making new laws. I'm interested in Canada and the Crown upholding their original intentions and their original laws that they have with Indigenous people. Those laws are over 500 years old, and they can't be honored. How would I expect a new law to be honored? You know, if Canadians don't even know their own history, like, why would I expect a new law to change that? And, you know, that's what we've seen time and time again. Like, even with the Charter, even with Section 35, we saw, you know, Indigenous people at the time include First Nation, Métis, and Inuit. And at the time, it was really needed. But now what we've seen the Canadian law do is put us into boxes that are First Nation, Inuit, or Métis. You know, and that's what Indigenous is. But in reality, there's so many Indigenous nations. And we might not all fit into these cute little boxes. So, like, just to bring it back to, like, some of those comments about immigrant folks. You know, imagine if, like, Mark, you were the representative for all immigrants. Like, that wouldn't make any sense, would it? You know, just like, I can't be the representative of all Indigenous people, because there's hundreds of Indigenous nations across North America. And so I want those laws to be upheld. They're already written. So, like, let's look at the Royal Proclamation. Let's look at how Canada was created. Let's look at the treaties. Let's look at the peace and friendship treaties. Let's look at the land that we live on. Are we living on occupied territory, or is there an agreement that was made there? You know, and like, so on and so on. So that's what I feel like about Canadian law.
That's a really key point to be made, because it's certainly vital that we should learn those things first and foremost before we just assume that they don't matter. And yet that's kind of precisely, I think, the attitude that's existed in previous generations to sort of sweep these things under the carpet. It's fascinating to me to hear that, though, in terms of the numbers that are out there. And I've gotten a sense of that in recent years, but I really don't have a full concept of it. So I would be very keen to hear that, hear more and more about that, obviously. Rajiv, I think you had something you wanted to jump in on there.
Thanks, Mark. I was going to comment that, you know, certainly there are laws that we need to change, but it's not always as onerous as introducing a new bill or a new law. And you know, to the point that was made earlier, there are laws, there are pieces of legislation right now which could be enforced better, which could be applied better. And I think there, even if we look at police officers, and for example, when a police officer is charged, you know, we're seeing existing laws at work doing good things. So I think there's enough opportunity to work with existing laws and basically have some advocacy. I always recommend, you know, things like advocating, whether it's writing to an elected official, or it, you know, encouraging others to be part of the voting process. I'm in my late 30s. A lot of my friends, you know, have the unfortunate idea that a vote, you know, isn't a priority. Obama said it best when he said, you know, democracy is not a secret. And I really believe in that. So I would really encourage anybody to, you know, the democratic system is participatory. So to certainly use advocacy and use your vote.
Well, and that's a you know, valid when you, you know, take into context what Gabrielle just said, in that no new laws necessarily will change anything, but certainly there likely are great, you know, laws that are in place currently that could be certainly upheld and monitored more closely, and that would perhaps help to change the attitudes of things. But speaking of changing attitudes, you know, is that the key thing here as opposed to anything else? I mean, in terms of the youth panelists here this evening, is it correct to believe that really just changing attitudes is really far more important than anything else at the moment? And if so, if that's the case, how do we do that? And again, that's the question we keep coming back to, but I sort of to repeat it, but that really seems to be the issue that's developing here, is that it's a matter of attitude more than anything else, and particularly perhaps a matter of attitude with the seniors of the community here, more so than the youth. Any thoughts further on that from Nadia?
I was just going to say, I feel like a lot of like youth or younger people, they're getting a lot of their information from social media. And I feel like maybe some older folks are not that familiar with using social media or using the computer and doing their research. So they're getting their information from CNN or Fox News. And so because of that, I think it's just them being uninformed sometimes. And because they see in the news, this is what they believe to be true. And even though it can be very like misconstructed and way more of a backstory to what's going on or some of the things that they do see online. So I would say to, I don't really have like an answer to that, but I did just want to add in that I think that's also like a huge factor to what's...
I agree. And the reality is that people in my age demographic who have traditionally believed in those sort of first run mainstream media type of news information are suffering from something else that's happening. And that is the loss of print media. When print media takes a story and develops it into a much greater story, be it a full page, be it two pages or whatever, that's far better than the 20 or 30 seconds of news that you're getting in a top story at 11 o'clock at night. So consequently, people who are no longer reading print media, of course, if you want you to be informed, really have to delve into those social media channels and some of the more independent news vehicles. And not everybody in my age demographic is necessarily following, you know, either BuzzFeed or Huffington Post or whoever, you know, Vice News and that sort of thing. So consequently, you've got a situation where there is a real gap there. So I concur completely on that point. Is there any kind of a general sense of hope, though, that social justice is really possible among the youth of today? Do we get a sense of a little bit of a despair coming from some of the comments here this evening? Is there a sense of hope anywhere here? Kira, what about you? I know that you're sometimes quite on the front lines of things. Do you see this as being more a matter of despair than hope?
Personally, I guess I'm in despair, but I think that's just me. I don't know. I think our generation might be a little bit more hopeful than just me personally. But I think for me, when George Floyd died, I left Canada. I went to Chicago to be with my Black family, you know, because I kind of figured like you never know what's going to happen. And to me, it's the same old, and nothing is really changing. We see these sparks of energy and things look good. And then, and not just for Black Lives Matter, for anything, we see these sparks of and energy, and then it kind of dissipates and disappears until the next killing happens or, you know, the next tragedy happens. And so for me, I'm feeling a little bit, I don't know, I feel like I'm less hopeful than the general populace of like my age cohort, which is like their early 20s. So.
Mm-hmm. Resonate with anyone else in terms of despair versus hope at this point? Which is it?
I would say, I love listening to the youth, though. I just want to say that first. And but I'm always hopeful. I mean, it's something that's carried me for the 62 years of my life, because I mean, some days I look back and I think, I thought this was going to change, and it hasn't really. But I'm still hopeful that the world is moving forward, and you know, listening to the youth and seeing what they're trying to do, you know, you have to believe that, you know, it's going to come together at some point. I mean, I think we're moving in the right direction. The people that are in power are trying to stay in power, and that's going to be the tough thing. But if we keep moving forward, in your own way, and you know, whether it's, you know, in the circles that you live in or the places that you work. I took the questions and put them in the bulletin in the lunchrooms, and you would be amazed at the conversations that started in those in lunchrooms in where I work, because I put those questions up. And so you have to find your way to make those little changes, to create the atmosphere so you can have a discussion and move things forward.
That's it. I would have liked to hear that conversation in the lunchroom. That must be quite interesting indeed. And good for you for doing that. Let's talk about momentum here for a moment, and then I think we'll begin to wrap this up a little bit. Do we see, first of all, that there is some momentum moving forward? Do we get a sense of that at all? And if so, what do we do, both youth and old folks like me and others, what do we do to keep that going? That it seems really critical that this might be the prime opportunity for us to actually capitalize on this situation, the way it's evolving, the way it has evolved in the last several weeks. Is there some precise way or an imprecise way to keep this momentum going? Sahara?
I think keeping the momentum going means active allyship. So as we've talked about, like how can adults or how can other people be more involved in this? And I think you just have to be an active ally. Learn more, like just don't take any news by face value. Understand where it's coming from, where the resources of it. Find proper scholarly papers talking about racialized minorities in Canada. I think the momentum is kind of within an individual, but also holding accountability, like holding corporations and the government accountable as well. As Gabby mentioned so eloquently before, she was talking about how now it's a generation of accountability, and I really do stand by that. It's not only about educating ourselves, it's about educating ourselves for us to be armed to hold everyone else around us accountable. And even if the conversations are uncomfortable with our friends or our colleagues, they have to happen, and they need to happen. Like it's about time. With regards to being hopeful or being kind of like apprehensive or kind of exhausted from it, I think some days I definitely feel much more exhausted. I think about, we're talking about Trayvon Martin. Like we can take it back so many years. We can look at Emmett Till with his, he had an open casket, and that led to, people were appalled. It didn't lead to that much movement. This was over 50 years ago now, where Emmett Till's casket was shown to the public to see the brutal murder of this 14-year-old boy. So it's hard for me to keep seeing Black and brown bodies die over and over again and then be broadcasted and then feel hopeful. It doesn't make me feel hopeful that there's this repetitive cycle where we need to move. Part of me needs to move faster. I understand patience is an important trait for every single person to have, but I think we need to put people's feelings aside because people are dying. Mm-hmm. And that's what I believe the proper momentum looks like. It's educating yourself, hurting people's feelings is much less of a negative consequence than actually seeing another Black or brown person die.
So this is a critical point in time, a critical point in history, a milestone, if you will, that we cannot allow to slip through our fingers in terms of making changes that are vital to this momentum. Is that a fair statement to make?
That is a very fair statement to make, yes.
I just wanted to add on to what Sahar was saying about holding people accountable for and hurting feelings as well. And I just wanted to say this targeted to other white people, or like, for example, myself, I haven't had to deal with discrimination because of my skin or my sexual orientation or my cultural religious background. And for other people who have also not experienced this and don't experience this in their daily life, it's easy to ignore. And right now, you're not ignoring it because it's all over the news. It's all over the media everywhere. But as you said, the momentum has died down in the past and it's not going to be in your face anymore. And so I think it's just a constant, being a constant ally, like calling out other people around you or addressing yourself and your own privilege and your own biases that you may have learned, and just keeping active, even if it's just with yourself and people around you and in your own environment. So, yeah.
Yeah. I concur, and I can hear that from others as well, that's really where grassroots starts, is with your own social circles, your families, and so on. Listen, I'm going to put a question to each of the youth, and it's regards to what they see as their role now and in the future in bringing about this social justice. So I'm going to start with Kira, if you wouldn't mind addressing that point for us.
What do I think my role is?
Yes.
That's a good question. I think number one, I want to be a listener. I want to, you know, acknowledge my own privilege. I do come from a certain amount of economic privilege. I think listening is as important as talking. So I want to hear what other people of color go through. I want to help to support them. And then I would ultimately like to be an advocate for change and work directly with the Black community in Chicago and in Hamilton and learn how we can also support other communities who are going through challenges like the Indigenous community. Right now in my own Black community, they have no idea what's going on with Indigenous people. They have no idea what's outside of their own community. So ultimately I'd like to also be a support system in my own community.
Well, it sounds like you've got your feet going in the right direction in that regard as it is. So Mark, what about yourself? Where do you see your role for change? I mean, you've got quite an intriguing company going there with the toys for children with disabilities and so forth, I believe. And that's a key interesting point, because if nothing else, that gives you the right attitude about where this needs to be, I would think, if nothing else. So do you have a role beyond that that you think could help to make some changes here? Well, Mark, are you mute, Mark?
Oh, mute.
Yeah, I'm on mute. My bad. I'm sorry, guys.
I can almost read your lips there, Mark.
No, okay. So right now, let me preface this. The reason why I went into entrepreneurship and the reason why I started my own business was because of the fact that if I was going to work hard, you know, if I was going to play the systemic game of meritocracy, I wanted to do it on my own terms, you know? And the reason why I bring that up now is because being in the position I'm in, I'm not rich. I'm not like any of that, just say that out. But having that freedom allows me to be able to make the partnerships and allows me to work with other communities within the space I'm in right now with full freedom and reign over what I'm doing. And after having talked to the special needs community and having talked to OTs, SLPs, and a bunch of specialists, you know, and connecting with the parents of whom do come from lower income neighborhoods, because that's primarily the demographic of whom comes to us. We don't even go to, they come to us. I realized there are these glaring disparities within not only just economic opportunities, but also just the financial barriers towards, you know, toys and products which make, you know, life more accessible for children with special needs. And if you are living in these communities and you are economically disenfranchised, or you are part of a minority and you aren't, there's so many facets and I can go on forever. So I'm just trying to like summarize what's going on in my brain. But basically working with these specialists, I realized that there is a very big disparity in how they're treating individuals of whom are minorities. So primarily like a lot of our customers are within California and San Diego. So there are a lot of Latin communities of whom aren't necessarily getting the OT help, so occupational therapy help that they need. And if they are, they're kind of getting brushed off. And being able to talk to the occupational therapists of whom are trying their best to be able to support these communities, I want to be able to step in and say, hey, look, like this is how we can support you financially. These are the things we can provide you. It's not a lot, but how else can we support? And that's basically where I'm coming at it from. I just wanted to be able to know that I could take a stance on things and not have to worry about whether or not I'd be fired from my job, I'd be fired from my position or whatever I'm doing, just because, you know, it's like, that's the whole reason why. Like, I just wanted to be able to make these decisions on my own and know that I can make the impact I need to, like in my own capacity. Well, I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it does. It does. I think it's a very honorable move on your part to take it to use that vehicle for that purpose. So I think that's a very smart move as well. Gabrielle, if you would, the same question to you. How do we? Where's your role now and in the future to in bringing about social justice? What do you see that is for you? How does that spell out?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that I don't believe that social justice, getting to social justice that we all want to see, I don't believe it's like an adult versus young people problem. As like from an Indigenous community, like working with our elders is so, so important to us. You know, it's not like a separate group of people. And so, you know, there's that intergenerational learning that we both learn from each other. And so I don't think that any of these issues are like adult versus young people. However, I do believe that older folks with higher economic positions have to acknowledge that they have privileges that young people might not. And so that's where I think the confusion is. And then beyond that, it's about, you know, like white privilege, male privilege, sexuality privilege, religion privilege, and so on. And so really understanding like where your privilege is, I think helps you understand where your role is in social justice. You know, are you in a position of power where you can uplift voices and actually take a step back? Or are you in a place where, you know, you've been through it and you have a ton of lived experiences and you need people to listen? And so I think those really make a big difference. And I wanted to also acknowledge that, you know, I believe that 99% of movements happen on the ground. Like you only, like 1% of the movement is actually in protests or marches. Mm-hmm. Like those big like things you see, that's like 1% of the movement. But we're always on the ground. We're always hustling. We're always trying to see better for our communities. We're always doing that hard, hard labor. And so just to remember that, and not to get too confused by the marches, like go out, support marches, be there, you know, write, like sign petitions, write letters, do all that stuff, but also like do the hard work too. You know, maybe that's being a mental health support. Maybe that's like donating money. Maybe it's just literally giving some money to that youth, you know, that is really trying to create change. You know, there's so, so many things each and one of us can do.
And your role currently then day to day is contributing to that, do you think? Do you feel?
Oh yeah, my role is just being there for young people, bringing back language opportunities, bringing back ceremony opportunities, supporting young people, giving them opportunities, not hoarding opportunities. I do a lot of things in the community. I hope that I can just create more opportunities for my peers.
Great. Okay. I'm going to put that question over to Nadia now, if you don't mind. Nadia, your role in currently and in the future, how do you see that bringing about social justice in your day-to-day life at this point?
I would say my role would be to continue educating myself, continue educating others when needed, to always be aware of the privileges that I do have, just as Gabrielle mentioned. And I guess at work to just hold those same standards as well, always, and to help my community in any way that I can.
And last word on that question, then, Sahar. Your role, how do you see it currently in terms of promoting social justice currently and into the future?
So I'm taking a little Arabic lesson. So the Arabic word for lawyer is mahami, which is the male version, and mahamiya is the female version, which translates to the word the protector. And I think when I went to law school, there was always this thing that you're going to a place where you're going to attain a lot of privilege. It doesn't matter what your background is. Once you're done the 3 years, you have so much privilege, and your role is now to protect. My role is to protect people's rights. My role is to advocate fearlessly, and it's part of our ethical duty. Part of being a part of the law society is to hold the justice system accountable. And I think I see where my privilege is, and I'm hopeful, and I'm my goal in life is to move forward and make sure that the justice system is being held accountable.
And sounds like a reasonable role to take at this point, given your background so far. Listen, I think I'd like to wrap this up, but at the same time, I'd like to kind of give final words to the adults in the crowd here, if I would. Perhaps, Rita, your thoughts on what you've heard this evening. Do you see hope or do you see despair in terms of change and the positive change that we're looking for in society today?
Well, I just wanted to say that I watched with great sadness the death of John Lewis and the memorializing of his life. And I actually watched a film on his march across the bridge in Selma and the behavior of the police and the behavior of politicians. And I quite frankly did not see that we had moved very far. And I was so despondent after that. And along with climate crisis and, you know, the recovery process following this pandemic and stuff, we have a lot of things on our plates. But I was particularly moved by the comments about white privilege and our role in dealing with that. And I just want to say that I think in terms of social justice, it's very like what we went through with things like violence against women, where we made such a huge move on trying to get men to speak up when they see filthy jokes being made about women, about men downgrading women and treating women badly and talking about how they abuse women and dealing with that. We need to do the same kind of thing with other things like racial violence and injustice. And I know it's my role, as far as I'm concerned, to rock the boat. I was saying to Carmel before we came onto this thing that if I'm not on somebody's shit list, I feel like I'm not doing my job. And I just make it a point whenever the opportunity arises to point out the consequence of making the kinds of comments or taking the attitudes and holding those views that disparage racialized people, the marginalized, the poor, the mentally ill, the unemployed, et cetera, et cetera. And if we cannot put ourselves in someone else's shoes, even for a moment, we are not being human. And I just feel like we have a lot of work to do. And I applaud the youth who are here today. I really appreciated what you guys have said. I've written down everything that you've said today, and I'm going to be talking about it with my colleagues, who are mostly old age pensioners, but you know, they pack a lot of punch. They vote, they show up at council meetings, they write letters to the newspaper, they rattle their sabers every chance they get, and they want to be heard. And that's what I'm going to keep doing. Thanks.
That's wonderful thoughts, Rita, and thank you for sharing that, because I concur and I feel similar in many ways to you in that sense. Rajiv, your thoughts here as to some of the impressions you've gained this evening, listening to this wonderful crowd of very insightful thinkers and activists as such. What have you got to say?
Well, you know, when I think of how I feel, whether I feel hopeful or not, I think this might be COVID time speaking, but it really depends on the day and the news. Mm. After this conversation we've had, let me tell you, I'm feeling very positive and incredibly hopeful. I think, you know, each of the panelists, I do some amazing things, and I would just say, you know, continue to do what you do, and never forget how important advocacy is. If it wasn't, you know, we wouldn't have a lobbying system. It's absolutely critical for all of us to continue with that, whether it's through our votes, encouraging others to vote, or working within the system to make sure that that bills are, that laws are followed as they should. We can have the best written bills and laws, but if where the rubber meets the road, if there's a problem in applying them, if it's ineffective, then what good is that bill? And I think that's part of all of us holding the government to account. And finally, I would just like to say thank you. It's been a great conversation.
Good. Well, good to have you here as well, Rajiv. And thanks for those thoughts as well. Renee, I see some list of questions for your lunchroom.
Definitely. I mean, creating the opportunity to have these conversations is a way to move people forward. And I'm you know, so thrilled actually to be able to participate in the panel and listen to the youth and all they've done is encouraged me to be more vigilant in terms of bringing these issues forward. And, you know, I've always done that through my life, but it's just wonderful to hear your enthusiasm and your, you know, the world will change if we all work together to change it. And you can only do what you can, but you always need to stand up when you hear something that isn't right, when you see something that isn't right, and, you know, put yourself out there and be brave and say, yeah, if something's wrong, say it's wrong and don't be afraid.
Yeah. Yeah. Very valuable thoughts there too. Indeed. Last word to our host and the inspiration behind this conversation, the reason why we're all here. Carmel, your thoughts.
First of all, thank you, Martin, for moderating the conversation. I'm known as having a loud voice and a very opinionated. So I needed somebody to temper me, and that was you. So thank you for stepping in. I want to thank everybody for participating in the panel, the adults and the youth. I think it's a very important conversation. Of course, I think we are, all of us, part of the converted. And really what we need to do is we need to convert. So, you know, in a secular way, we are the disciples of change. And that's who you are. And after listening to each of you, I, who is a converted, have learned things tonight. And I want to, that's because of each of you. I really appreciated everyone's opinions. I actually learned something tonight. A 57-year-old Middle Eastern man who's grown up 52 years in Canada has actually learned something tonight from each and every one of you. So thank you. I just want to send a little message out to those of you who feel that sometimes you're not being heard or heard enough or thought of how can you bring about change. I am hopeful that change will be brought about. I am. I always believe in the power of goodness and in the power of truth. And the little analogy I want to leave you with is this. A little speck or hole in the wall can brighten an entire dark room. That's the power of truth. And all I would suggest as we move forward is when you identify a problem, identify a solution. I despise, or maybe that's too strong of a word, somebody who just complains. If you're going to complain, propose a solution. Don't complain unless you have a proposal. As good or bad as it is, if it's with the right intent, always have a proposal and move it forward in whatever way you think is right. So all the best to each and every one of you. Thank you, Martin. I am so motivated to be more vigilant, and I always think I am, but more vigilant after learning what I've learned tonight. So thank you to everyone. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedules. And thank you. I'm sure that we will all have this connectivity moving forward, and we all have each other to call upon when we need to moving forward. So thank you so much.
Again, thank you.
I have an article recommendation. I'm going to share it in our chat. It's called Whiteness as Property by Cheryl Harris from 1993. It's probably one of the best articles I've ever read in law school in my life. And I think it gives you, it's a conversation starter for so much of where we see, like how we view whiteness. And I do recommend, everyone I talk to, I recommend this article for.
Wonderful. Yeah, thanks for sharing that, Sahar. I'll definitely look at it.
Whiteness of what?
Whiteness
of property.
Rita, yes, there you go.
I'll email you, Rita.
Yeah, we'll get it.
Got it.
Cool.
I can find it.
Listen, folks, I too have learned a great many things. There's several notes that I have made along the way here this evening as well, and I appreciate your input dramatically as so, because it's going to, I think, help change my life, and I trust that it will also hopefully change those I come in contact with, because I'm being empowered just listening to you all. I hope we do indeed cross paths again. But until then, I'm going to sign off and say goodnight, and I think we'll leave it at that.
You have been listening to Scotch Friday Podcast and our special series on social justice. This was our final episode comprised of our youth panel. My name is Carmel Sacrin, and I invite you to share your comments on our website at www.scotchfridays.ca. Until next time. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.